Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This podcast includes discussion of self-harm, suicide and sexual assault. Please listen with care. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact the Need to Talk helpline anytime, day or night, by texting or calling 1737. A wider list of mental health support services can be found on our show page, www.rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby.
It's Christmas time. Sarah has finally arrived in New Zealand from the UK, and because she's on holiday, she's got lots of spare time to think about our search for her birth mother, Nellie. That's good, because our current plan is to meet in Wellington in mid-January, so we're rapidly running out of time. Luckily, Sarah's really taken to the role of investigator. She started sending me regular voice memos to update me on her progress.
Well, I wanted to check was the timeline, which I haven't done, which I can do. I'll do that now. Between when she was admitted to the hospital and when she died. Because if she was admitted in the morning and died in the afternoon, and then also how do we get hold of the police? Is that possible? They meant to come back to me in 20 days, and they came back saying they wanted to extend it. But it's been well over another 20 days. So I asked why, and that...
These memos arrive sporadically. Sometimes I get 5 a day, and then I won't hear anything for a week. And they pop up at the weirdest times.
And we're in Starbucks at like 8 o'clock at night, which is really weird because they're not open that late at home. What else was I going to say? Oh man, this morning when I said...
But I'm into it. Usually, as an investigative journalist, I work on my own. And having Sarah is like having a co-conspirator. I send memos back. Mine are mainly about logistics and the various arguments that I'm having with government departments about the information we still haven't received months after requesting it.
Anyway, so I ring Heather thinking I can just have a discussion with her and point out that I think they've made a mistake, try and avoid making a complaint to the Ombudsman because it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort for everyone. She just refused to talk to me about it. Which is so frustrating, like, as media.
But it's not all fun and games with Sarah playing detective and me moaning about closed-mouth government departments. There's a group of people who haven't really come into our story until now. Sarah's adoptive family. They live near Wellington. Sarah is their only child. Sarah's been waiting for the right time to tell her adoptive parents that she's been working with me on this podcast. She wanted to wait until she was home in New Zealand and to do it in person because she knows that for her adopted mother in particular, it's going to drag up a lot of possibly painful feelings from the past, and she really doesn't want to hurt her.
It's really difficult because, I mean, I can't really speak for her, but I think she wasn't supported at all by the system when she adopted me. So they literally just like handed this baby to her, and I was like quite disturbed, told. I wouldn't be held. I didn't want to be cuddled. I didn't want to be picked up. I was very angry. I cried. I had reflux. My father worked away on the ferries. So he worked away half the time. So she was just by herself in the middle of the country with a screaming child that she didn't know how to look after and wasn't really supported at all.
Even though Sarah doesn't think her adoptive parents will want to be involved in the podcast themselves, she still wants them to know about her search for Nellie.
We haven't really talked about it that much because we've only discussed my birth family really once. That's why it's difficult to have that conversation, especially on the other side of the world, like over the telephone.
But now she's here, Sarah's really struggling to find the words to explain to them why it's so important to her.
I'm going to leave it a couple of days. But I don't want to leave it too long because then it seems like I'm hiding it from her. And I want to be able to tell her in person
She's asking me for a lot of advice and she seems really anxious about it, which is unlike her. She's usually really confident.
I just wanted to talk to you about how I can phrase it. So I can say, you know, you were thinking of doing a podcast, basically look into how the system has failed many people in the cases of adoptions.
When I ask if she's okay, Sarah says being in New Zealand and knowing that in a few weeks we're going to go to Porirua Hospital, where Nelly lived, suddenly makes it all feel really real.
I think also it's because I'm reading lots of books on trauma at the moment, so that's kind of interesting, and so that's raised lots of issues for me. But yeah, so that's probably why I'm quite emotional at the moment.
I suggest Sarah takes a few days off working on the podcast. This is partly for her sake and partly for mine. I've managed to catch COVID and I'm too sick to work. I don't hear from Sarah for nearly a week. And then, just as I'm beginning to feel better, I get this voice memo from her that, maybe partly because I'm still sick, I can barely keep up with.
It's really exciting because all of a sudden, you know, it just pops up and it says, pops up close match, and it says first cousin or closer. But I just sort of thought it was a cousin. And then when I actually looked
it's the DNA test Sarah did with Ancestry. It's back, and I think she's saying there's a match there that's genetically really close to her.
I know genetics, and my parents would be 50% of the DNA each. And obviously a full sibling would share about 50% of their DNA with me. So a half sibling is 25 or around there, and she's got 28% shared DNA with me. I presume someone who knows more about genetics could look at the Ancestry site and find out whether she's on my mother's side or my father's side. So I think we'll work out that first.
As usual, Sarah's about 100 steps ahead of me here. She's saying there's a woman in the database with a 28% match to her DNA, and she thinks that means they're her half-sister. I don't want to leap to conclusions. I've never worked on a story involving a DNA test before, and I really don't understand what these numbers mean. Fortunately, I've already found someone who can help us. I'm Kirsty Johnston, and this is Nelly's Baby, Episode 3, I Found Him.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, is that Fran?
It is. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
This is Fran Tyler. Fran is a journalist with decades of experience in court reporting, but more recently she's quit the trade to set up a business called Genealogy Investigations. Her business partner is another journalist named Deb Morris, who's a former colleague of mine. That's how I knew about them. Fran and Deb use skills they've learned in newsrooms to help people track down their missing family members. As part of this work, they help people interpret DNA results. Sarah sent Fran her login to the DNA website ahead of our conversation, so she's actually looking at Sarah's family tree while we talk, and so am I.
So how does it work? So Sarah, what did she even upload to get it?
Okay, so the way it works is that you provide a saliva sample, and that's sent off to Ireland in this case with Ancestry. They test it for DNA markers. And then they upload that to a database, and then it runs in a program algorithm, I suppose, and it matches up to others who share the same DNA markers to you. And then it works out. It depends on how many, they're called centimorgans, so that's sort of a measurement for DNA you match to another person, and you can work out roughly what the relationship is with the person, depending on how many centimorgans you share in common with the other person. Does that make sense?
I think so. What's a centimorgan again?
It's kind of, it's like a measurement of DNA.
In case you couldn't tell, it didn't make sense because I still had no idea what a centimorgan was. I googled it afterwards and it's basically a unit of genetic measurement. I find it helpful to think of it less like the physical units we use in everyday life, like meters or grams, but more a measurement of probability. So the more centimorgans you share with someone, the more likely you are to be closely related. Your parents, for example, share around 3,500 centimorgans with you. A first cousin would share more like 1,000. But it can range. They might share as little as 500 or as much as 1,200 centimorgans, depending on what bits of DNA you both ended up with.
Okay, so Sarah's done hers.
Yes.
What can you see there?
She's got some really nice close matches, actually. So we've got one person described as a close family, perhaps first cousin, and then we've got 1, 2, 3 first to second cousins, which is actually really good. It's helpful to have that many close matches. The interesting one is Sharon. She shares 1,947 centimorgans, which if you look at who would have that level of shared DNA, it's likely to be a half-sibling, so a half-sister in this case. It could also be an aunt or uncle, or it could be a niece or nephew. Those people all share roughly that level of DNA with the person who's tested.
So how do you work out, like, who Sharon is? How do we do that?
We'd have to do some research.
We start with Sharon's family tree, which she's built on Ancestry.com. It's public, but there's only 5 people listed as being related to her. It's hard to decipher who's who in the tree, but it seems like there's a mother and a father and then 3 children, including Sharon. The mother in the tree is named Thelma, but the father isn't named. He's listed as private, which could mean he's still alive but doesn't want to be identified, or maybe that Sharon, who built the tree, doesn't actually know who he is. Fran begins to search to see if she can identify more about Thelma and this mystery man.
We should just do a search on Ancestry for Thelma. I'll do that now. Hold on. All right, while I do that, you might have to edit this.
My heart's in my chest, to be honest. What, so are you getting any spidey sense of this?
I think we're going to get somewhere. Okay, so I found an entry here for Thelma. She appears in 24 trees. A lot of these are copied from each other, and the other problem about family trees online is the information is only as good as the person that put that information in there. So when you're looking, you should actually look for information that's sourced back to actual records. So, okay, let's have a look at this tree. It's got a lot of sources on it. Okay, so it looks like Thelma had 2 husbands, one named Barry, and another one who's listed as private. So that person may still be alive, but one of their children has passed away, so I can see a surname there that might be helpful.
Just a note, we're not using anyone's last names at this stage for privacy and possibly legal reasons, basically in case it identifies Sarah's birth father.
The one who looked to be Sharon's father, his first name is Barry. But he died in 1963, according to this family tree, which is not going to make it possible for him to have been Sarah's father.
No, because she was born in 1984.
Yeah, so he died 21 years before she was born. It's unlikely. But let's double check that, see whether Barry actually died in 1963, as said.
For the next while, Fran and I dig through various websites looking for clues about Thelma and Barry. I can see why Fran likes genealogy. It's so similar to the kind of work I used to do as a crime reporter. You have only the tiniest snippets of information at the start, but can eventually begin to build a picture of someone's life.
So we can try the New Zealand Birth, Death and Marriages Register.
We find that Barry and Thelma lived in Napier, which is on the east coast of the North Island, about 4 hours from Wellington. They had 5 children. They got married really young. He was 22 and she was 20. He was a labourer. And it turns out he was also something of a drinker. A newspaper article from 1962 records how, in December that year, Barry appeared before the Hastings District Court for his 6th offence of driving while disqualified. He was sentenced to 3 months imprisonment and banned from driving for another 18 years. Eventually, Fran finds a record of Barry's gravestone among the Napier City Council's cemetery records. There's a photo. It's tiny, just a little metal headstone set in concrete at ground level, amid the plots for war veterans. There's nothing about Thelma or his kids on the plaque. It doesn't even have his birthday. But it does confirm when he died.
He definitely died in 1963, so we can rule him out as being father.
I had my hopes up about Barry there for a minute. But Fran says our research can still be put to good use, because in another scenario, Barry and Thelma might actually be Sarah's grandparents.
So let's work on the basis that we're looking at an aunt-niece relationship. So that would mean that Sharon's father was Barry, and one of Sharon's siblings is Sarah's parent.
Ah, okay.
So let's see if we can find out who Barry's children were. So we had two who we know. They're named in a family tree. So one is born 1955, who's Gordon, and the other one is Diane.
We rule Diane out because we're looking for Sarah's father, and we already know her mother is Nellie.
So let's have a quick look at Gordon, see if we can find any information about Gordon. No, there's nothing on this tree that's going to be useful, but we can click the search button, see what comes up.
Fran keeps searching, but there's no more information about Gordon. If he was born in 1955, he won't appear in the Births, Deaths and Marriages Register because those records are kept secret for 80 years.
Yeah, no, there's nothing. No, nothing that would fit. So, no.
Okay, so if we want to go down that idea of thinking that one of the siblings, like Gordon or someone else, might be Sarah's father, we're probably going to have to ring them.
Well, we could make contact with Sharon and ask her if she's willing to help. She may not.
How does that normally go when you're doing this kind of thing?
Sometimes people are really open to the idea, and other times people are incredibly nervous and closed about the whole idea because they don't like to think that their parent may have had another child somewhere else, or their sibling may have had another child that they didn't know about. So, yeah, it really depends on who you strike.
Fran says this is the part where many people tend to give up. They get overwhelmed by all these names and numbers and charts and the thought of reaching out to strangers, and they simply close the computer and don't bother picking it back up again. Frankly, I can see why. It is a lot to take in, and I'm wondering if we're even anywhere close.
Do you think this is promising?
Absolutely. I think this is very promising. I mean, we've got someone who's a really close relative.
Okay.
So,
shall our first port of call be to message Sharon, because she might be able to save us a bunch of time?
Yeah, I would do that. Put that message through to her, appeal to her good nature, and see whether she is willing to help.
Failing that, we'll be spending some time in the library.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't get hold of Sarah, so I leave her a message saying, effectively, Fran agrees with her. Sharon is likely her half-sibling or her aunt, but it's still pretty uncertain. I also pass on what Fran says, that she thinks the fastest way to work out the family tree might be just to message Sharon, but I say we can discuss how Sarah feels about doing that first if she wants. A bit later, I get a message from Sarah about Sharon. She's wondering about whether to contact her or not.
I noticed her profile says private, and so does her father's, and it says living, which could mean that they've seen me and gone, oh, quick, we don't want her to contact us, let's make it that. Or it could mean they just have it's private. Or it could mean that perhaps she is looking, but she doesn't, she's not sure if she wants to be contacted, but she does want to know.
I know the headspace Sarah's in right now. Well, not exactly, because I've never had a situation where it's personal like this. But there's always this point in any investigation where you have to make this leap into the unknown. And it's always so fraught, because you can't predict what's going to happen, so you instead imagine all the various possibilities ahead of time. I guess it's kind of a self-protection mechanism, because if you've already thought about the worst case scenario, it takes out this element of surprise.
If it's my father's side, I guess there's a high likelihood he won't want to be found. Because of course, yeah, either he would have been a patient, in which case he's probably still a patient, impatient, or he would have been someone who took advantage of her.
Sarah is running through myriad possibilities about her father and her mother and how she was conceived. One of these even includes whether Nellie's cigarette addiction might have been involved somehow.
Perhaps even the doctors or social workers or nurses and ward staff used to use them for sex and give them cigarettes in return, because my mother would have done anything for a cigarette, you know. So maybe that's where I come from. But, yeah, let me know. Where do you think I should message her? Not message her. Ignore it. Wait till your genealogy person has had a quick look.
I listen to this message while I'm out walking my dog. I can understand why Sarah wants advice. I would too if I were in her shoes. The thing is, I'm not the right person to give it. As a journalist, I have a vested interest in wanting to find out more. So I message back briefly, saying there's no rush and she should just take some time to think about it. I figure we can talk in a few days when she's back in Wellington. But as always, Sarah is a few steps ahead of me. 2 days later, I get a text.
Okay, I've just started recording because I was at the post shop sending a Christmas gift to a friend and I got a text message from Sarah. So I'm just walking back to my car. Hang on. And of course I can't find my key. Okay, it says, found my dad. I worked it out yesterday with the DNA, but Sharon messaged back and confirmed it. Plus, I have a half-brother and a niece, and he lives in Porirua. So, I guess she messaged Sharon, the person on the Ancestry DNA that had the 28% match with her. I'm just going to try and call Sarah on WhatsApp. But it says she's not online. Wow, I'm puffing. I'm so excited. I can't believe she's found him. Okay, I'm gonna drive home, and hopefully by the time I get there, Sarah will be back online, because I really want to know what's happened. Anyway, I'm gonna stop recording.
I get stuck in traffic on the way home, of course. The whole drive, I can see my phone flashing with messages from Sarah, which is excruciating. As soon as I get home, I play them.
So, very exciting. I think I found my dad. I spent all afternoon yesterday looking at the DNA because I had a match.
Just like Fran and I had done a couple of days earlier, Sarah had begun looking into Barry and Thelma's family tree.
Might be my sister.
She'd worked late into the night, finding electoral rolls, spending hours drawing huge family trees on scraps of paper. Eventually, she decided that Sharon was most probably her aunt, her father's sister.
So that was a bit exciting, and I didn't know whether to message her. I thought maybe she's seen me, and maybe she doesn't want to have anything to do with me, and maybe my dad doesn't want to have anything to do with me. And so I sat on it for a few days and got all scared.
But after a couple of days, Sarah says she screwed up her courage.
I sent her a message, and she sent me some messages back, which is very exciting. So she sent back, "Hi, wow, this is interesting. I'm in Australia, but I'm from New Zealand. Sounds like I might be your auntie." And in the message, I messaged that I thought it might be one of her brothers, but she said, "Oh, where did you get that name from?" Because she had five brothers, two of them in particular had no problem in sharing their DNA with as many women as possible. So I thought, well, maybe I've got it wrong, and maybe I've read the DNA wrong, and actually I wouldn't come down that line. She says, "If it's Gordon, he has no idea, and if it is, then he'd love to be in contact with you." So I said, "Oh gosh, you know, I think it is this person, Gordon." And she sent back, "Our family is very confusing. I'm Sharon. I have a younger half-brother, and his mum and my stepfather's son. My mother had eight kids, her mother had eight, and her mother had eight too. Gordon is mentally disabled. He's slow and repeats himself a bit, but he's a lovely guy. Brian is in New Zealand near his girls. He's got about seven kids scattered around New Zealand. Stephen's in Australia. He mostly does farm work. Diane is in Melbourne. I've sent her a DNA test, so it'll be interesting what comes up hers. Vicky left New Zealand quite young and ended up in the US, where she shot herself about 18 years ago. And Kevin lived in Australia from about 18. He died from a heart attack at this time 3 years ago. Then there's me. I'm in Perth in Australia, and I work in the mines driving buses."
Okay, so there are four brothers who could potentially be Sarah's father: Gordon, Brian, Stephen, and Kevin. Sarah tells Sharon she thinks it might be Gordon.
"I don't know how I knew that." And she said, "What makes you think it's Gordon?" She thought it was actually going to be one of her other brothers, but I just had this feeling, so that was very weird.
Sharon's sceptical. She explains that Gordon is intellectually disabled. At the time Sarah was conceived, he was a patient at Porirua Hospital. Sarah can't believe it. She tells Sharon that her mum, Nellie, was also a patient at Porirua Hospital at that exact same time.
It's like, oh my goodness, that's the only person it could be, would be your dad.
And it's not what she feared. Gordon isn't some nurse or doctor or social worker. He was a fellow patient, someone in the same situation as Nellie.
Yeah, in terms of how I feel really happy, because I think I just always thought, like growing up, I always thought I just wasn't wanted. You know, I just thought my mum and dad just didn't want me. And then when I found out this information about my mum, I obviously realised, you know, she couldn't have me. She wanted me, but she couldn't have me. And so then I just had this thought that, you know, there's someone... I did understand it might have been another patient, but I sort of... I also thought, gosh, you know, what if it wasn't and it was a doctor or nurse? So I thought, well, maybe it's a doctor, you know, and then they just didn't want me and I was just discarded. And growing up adopted, you just feel unwanted. You feel like you don't belong, you don't have a place, you can't fit into society, you know, and you just feel like a little alien. And then to sort of know that I have two people who probably did really want me, you know, if he's mentally obviously disabled and she obviously was, they probably wanted me, but, you know, so of course they couldn't have me. So it's really for the first time I sort of feel a bit more like I belong properly. And it'll be amazing to see a picture, because of course you grow up and you don't really know where you get your bits from. You don't really know where your hair colour comes from. And my eye colour, I always knew my dad would have blue eyes because my mum didn't, and I knew he'd probably have fair hair because my mum didn't, so that's genetics, you know. But I'll get to see a picture, hopefully, or hopefully we can meet him. I have asked if he understands, you know, if he is disabled, if he understands the concept of daughter, and obviously if he does understand and would want to meet me, that would be amazing. You know, that would be something really cool. And then of course it took me about half an hour, and I reread the messages, and then I realized that he already has a child, which means I have a brother and niece, because he's got a daughter. So that's really exciting, because I thought, you know, I always wanted a little brother. Don't know if it's a little brother or older brother, but I always wanted a brother. So yeah, I'm really excited. It's sort of quite emotional. It's sort of, it'd be quite, I don't know. It's just such a strange feeling, you know. And then to hear that, gosh, so many, this huge family, it's really overwhelming.
Eventually, Sarah and I catch up on the phone. I know she's excited, I mean, so am I, but I'm trying to be cautious. I read her a message from Fran. She's warned me that we still need to check everything properly before we know for sure if Gordon is Sarah's father.
She's like a little bit more cautious than both of us, whereas I was just like jumping up and down, like clapping my hands. She was like, calm down. she said... sounds likely it's Gordon, but at this point it could still be any of the four male members of the family.
I also thought that, because I was like, what if they... It's actually my mum who suggested this. She said, oh, I bet she used to sell herself for cigarettes, basically. So she could have come across someone visiting, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, sorry, so she going. Said, can we check somehow to make sure, like, get him to do a DNA test?
We could, but it's just we couldn't do it beforehand because they take so long to come back. How long did they take to come back in this country?
I have no idea, and it's Christmas time, right? So
that's what I mean. Because I mean, in the UK, it was ages. Like, that was 3 months maybe or something, 2 months that I wanted to come back.
The logistics at this point seem difficult. Gordon is in assisted living, so we need someone to explain the test to him and to help him take it. And then the wait would be likely weeks, if not months. And Sarah doesn't want to wait. She thinks the best way might be to arrange to meet Sharon and have her arrange an introduction to Gordon and go from there.
I sent a message asking if she was coming to visit her daughters for Christmas because they're both in New Zealand. So her two daughters in New Zealand. So I wondered if she was coming over.
Do you think, did she reply yet though?
She hasn't replied yet, no.
We don't have to wait long, though. Sarah gets a message back from Sharon that night. Turns out, Sharon is coming to New Zealand in early January. She says she would love to meet Sarah. And she thinks Gordon would, too. Thanks Thanks for listening to Nellie's Baby. If you liked this program, make sure to follow or subscribe using your favourite podcast app or listen ad-free at rnz.co.nz. While you're there, you can browse RNZ's excellent range of podcasts like Dear Wars, Conviction, and The Detail, our daily news podcast. You can also find a whole lot of Nellie's Baby's extras, including feature articles, photographs, and bonus podcasts at our show page, rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby. And that's Nellie spelled N-E-L-L-I-E.
Nellie's Baby is written and presented by Kirsty Johnston. The executive producers are John Hartevelt and Tim Watkin. The producers are William Ray and Justin Gregory. The sound engineers are Phil Benge, Mark Chesterman and William Saunders. Our designer is Hing Yi Kong and our videographer is Cole Easton Farrelly. Our audio production team includes Steve Burridge, Jeremy Ansell, Rangi Powick, Corey Fuimaono, Daniel Hurley and Blair Stagpool. Special thanks to all those who helped make this podcast, including Sarah, Hilary Stace and Dr. Olive Webb. Ka kite anō.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.